This is Victoria, producer for The Felon File, a podcast on law enforcement history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains of the United States and beyond. Listen to in 39 countries around the world. Scott Lunsford hosts The Felon File. Scott is a retired American police sergeant. Background and intro music through purpleplanet.com.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of The Felon File. As you've heard, our friend Victoria is running the control board and recording for us today. And as a matter of fact, she was also the source for today's Shade of Blue story and did some of the research for us and brought some of the research sources together for us. And as she said, I am your host, Scott Lunsford, alleged retired law enforcement officer, researcher, sergeant, retired detective sergeant, SRO, all around wearer of many hats, too many to count, and just enough to drive me crazy. And we're coming to you today, recorded, of course, from the backwoods on a mountain in western North Carolina, where we're watching the birds fly and the bees sing. If you're listening to us from someplace other than the United States, thank you for tuning in. We appreciate it. And if you'd like to reach out to us, you can do so at felonfile@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, possible story ideas and comments and opposing viewpoints. If I don't like it, I just ignore it. But we'll try to put some information out there that you might find of interest. As a layman, you know, somebody, quote, not a doctor, we have learned other medical information stories or medical information and stuff from basically the TV and books we've read. Emergency, the TV show, still on in reruns. The soap opera General Hospital. ER. One of my favorites, MASH, Mobile Army Surgical Hospital, and of course other TV shows. Even as what they call not a doctor, most people are aware of the Hippocratic Oath. Now, it's an oath of ethics historically taken by doctors. It's one of the most widely known Greek medical texts that's out there. Initially, it required a new doctor to swear by the name of several of these Greek gods, all of them supposedly healing gods, to uphold specific ethical standards. Probably one of the earliest examples of medical ethics in the Western world. Do no harm. It established several acts and practices of medical ethics that are still important today. The confidentiality of medical situations and non-malfeasance. The ancient text is more than a historic and a symbolic thing. It's also part of legal statutes in various jurisdictions, such that the oath violations may actually carry criminal liability above and beyond their symbolic nature. Written in Ionic Greek between the 5th and 3rd centuries BC, although it's traditionally attributed to the Greek doctor Hippocrates. I understand that historians don't think it was written by him. And just like the advertisements say, just because you say it so doesn't really mean it is. But we tend to trust our doctors to take care of us. And odds are, most likely will. Though in every profession there are some bad apples. The mechanic who says he fixed the car but didn't. The bartender who waters down the drinks. Unfortunately, when you're counting on one of the bad apples to take care of you and fix what's wrong, it can end in a very final way. There's something especially frightening about a doctor who murders his patients. Someone who spends years learning how to heal and save lives starts killing the people he's supposed to be helping. Messes with our perception of just what a good guy and what a bad guy is. Some examples: Marcel Petrat promised victims safe refuge from the Nazis, and instead of giving them a safe refuge, he killed and robbed them. He's confirmed to have killed 23 people and suspected of the death of 63 others. Kermit Gosnell, a Philadelphia abortionist, killer of several of his patients. His confirmed victims are 4. His suspected victims are 100 plus. Max Petrov, he paid home visits and robbed his victims while they were unconscious. He has 12 confirmed victims and suspected of 19 others. He's from St. Petersburg, Russia, and he would visit patients at home. The first indication that there was something wrong was he was doing house calls. He would arrive unannounced, and then he'd inject the patient with an anesthetic of some sort and then steal their belongings while they were unconscious. He graduated up to murder over time and was arrested in Russia in January of 2000, 23 years ago. Thomas Nell Cream. Cream first started practicing medicine in Chicago, frequently performing illegal abortions for ladies of the evening. In 1881, several of his patients died, including a Daniel Slott, who was found to have died of strychnine poisoning after a supposed remedy for his epilepsy was given. Slott's wife turned out to be the good doctor's mistress, who later turned state's evidence on the doctor, and he was sent to prison and released in 1891 when his brother ended up bribing authorities. Well, to make things a little bit better for himself, he left country after he got out of prison, moved to London, where unfortunately several ladies of the evening there died of strychnine poisoning after having and sharing a drink with the good Dr. Cream. Dr. H. Holmes, said to be America's first known serial killer. I disagree with that, and speculated that he killed his childhood friend's playmate. After finishing medical school, he worked as a pharmacist in Chicago. He soon started killing people to steal their property. He built a house that became known as a murder castle. There's a lot of information on Holmes. He is a scary guy. Walter Freeman. Freeman was an American physician and advocate of psychosurgery. Because he had no surgical training, he initially worked with other surgeons. He gradually decided he didn't need their help, and he became the first in the United States to perform a prefrontal lobotomy. Dr. Freeman even used an ice pick to do these lobotomies. It was actually one from his own personal kitchen. That is, until he broke it off in somebody's skull. Mengele, the evil man, received his medical degree in 1938, the same year he joined the German SS under Hitler and the Nazi Party. He was promoted at one point to captain of the SS, was transferred to Auschwitz, where he became chief camp physician, soon known as the Angel of Death for his deadly experiments on prisoners. Now, this is our main shade of blue story. We're going to focus on one of these doctors, one not too well known in the United States and possibly other parts of the world, but he's pretty well known in England. That's what Victoria tells me. Harold Frederick Shipman, born in 1946, died in 2004. Known as Fred Shipman, he was an English general practitioner, or general doctor. He was given the nickname Dr. Death by the press. He is the only British doctor to date convicted of murdering his patients. However, other doctors have been acquitted of similar crimes or convicted on lesser charges. He has 250 victims, and possibly as many as 260 to 300. The Shipman inquiry that happened after he was figured out A 2-year investigation of all the deaths certified by Shipman or possibly connected to him. The analysis showed Shipman targeted elderly patients that trusted him as their doctor. He killed his victims either by a fatal dose of drugs or prescribing them an unusual or abnormal amount of medication. Depending on who you ask or who is writing about him, he is considered to be one of the most prolific serial killers in modern history. On January 31st of 2000, Shipman was found guilty of murdering 15 patients. He was sentenced to life imprisonment. Shipman ended up dying by suicide by hanging himself in his cell at HM Prison Wakefield in West Yorkshire. He was 57 years old. Now, who was Harold Shipman? Well, he was born in 46, graduated from Leeds School of Medicine, and been working as a doctor in 1970. He was the middle child in a middle-class family. He was the favorite child of a demanding and controlling mother, Miss Vera. She pushed the idea of his superiority over others. As you can imagine, that made keeping friends and getting friends and later girlfriends a little difficult to do. When his mother was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer, he took care of her as much as he could for such a young man. She was prescribed the administration of morphine. Now, how the drug worked and released her pain from cancer intrigued and fascinated him. She died from the disease in 63. Her death gave him the desire to go to medical school. After some time, he ended up being admitted to Leeds University Medical School for training. 2 years after his mother passed away, he had failed the entrance exams the first time. His upbringing made him a bit of a loner. He did meet his future wife, Primrose, at the age of 19, and they were married when she was 17, and 5 months pregnant with their first child. By 1974, he was the dad of two. He joined a practice in Yorkshire, England, and first did very well in the practice of working as a very community popular family practitioner. This is until he became addicted to painkillers, forging prescriptions for the drug until he ended up being caught and removed from the practice. In 1975, he ended up going to rehab. Legal-wise, he was given a small fine and convicted of forgery instead of what he was really doing. A few years later, showing that he had finally got his act together, he got work in Donnybrook Medical Center in Hyde, England. In 1992, he broke away from this group and set up his own private practice. His warm bedside manner and the time and care he lavished on his patients made the bespectacled gray-bearded physician a local favorite, especially among the elderly female population. And he was the model of the hard-working doctor. He gained the trust of patients and colleagues alike. But like before, he had a reputation of arrogance in grade school and college, and that followed him into his profession. Working for almost 20 years, his fellow doctors didn't see anything really out of the ordinary. Shipman was very popular in the community, especially, like I said, with the older ladies. Leastwise, while they were alive. However, the local undertakers started to notice that doctors' patients appeared to be dying a little bit unusually more frequently than other doctors. Even for senior citizens, his average seemed to be on the high side. Most of the deaths were at home. When the undertaker arrived at the death scene, the decedent's body position was usually all very similar. Several things that pointed something amiss to the mortician was that most of the deceased were fully clothed. They were all very similar posed in death. The doctor had just visited them or was still there when the undertaker arrived, and usually they were found dead sitting up or reclining in a chair. The mortician was concerned enough to approach Dr. Shipman himself about this. Well, of course, a good doctor told the man not to worry about it. Yeah, people die. Later, another doctor, a Miss Susan Booth, also found the situation disturbing. And the local coroner's office was alerted, which in turn contacted local police. An undercover investigation soon followed, but Shipman was cleared. A review of the patient's medical records showed nothing unusual, and that death was fairly well expected of all of them. All the medical records seemed to match up with what happened. A quick investigation, not showing anything to give concern, led the authorities to avoid contacting the General Medical Council, England's answer to the AMA. They also did not do a background records check on the doctor. After all, he was a doctor. And they did not find about his previous drug abuse and prescription forging. This would have shown some evidence of Shipman's previous criminal record and his history of criminal forgery. Later, a more thorough investigation revealed that Shipman altered his patient's medical records to collaborate the cause of death. Hiding behind his status as a caring family doctor, it was impossible to establish precisely when Shipman began killing his patients or exactly how many of them died at his hands. And of course, he denied every accusation made against him in reference to his patients. When you mess with a family, at least one member usually doesn't take no for an answer. In this particular case, it was Angela Woodruff, the daughter of one of his victims. She refused to accept the explanation for her mother's death the doctor was giving her. Her mother, Kathleen Grundy, was an active, well-off 81-year-old widow and was the mayor of Hyde City, where the doctor's offices was. She was discovered dead in her home on June 24, 1998, following an earlier visit by Dr. Shipman. Shipman told the daughter that it wasn't necessary to do an autopsy, and it ended up that the mother was buried following her daughter's wishes. Too bad for Dr. Shipman. The daughter was, in fact, a lawyer and handled all of Mom's affairs. It was a really big surprise to her when she discovered that Mom had another will, and that this document existed and that it would leave most of her mother's estate to the good Dr. Shipman. A fortune of nearly £400,000. Victoria, how much is that in U.S. dollars?
£400,000 is approximately $505,732. In United States dollars, Scott.
Thank you, Victoria. Woodruff knew this was a forgery or had to be one. This put her on the track that Shipman must have murdered her mother, and he forged the will to benefit from her death. She alerted the local police, going over the evidence and information. Detective Superintendent Bernard Postles quickly came to the same conclusion. Mom's body was exhumed. This time, a detailed postmortem revealed that she had died of a morphine overdose that was given to her approximately 3 hours before she died, right around the time that the doctor had been visiting with her. A court order search of Shipman's home was done. It turned up medical records, and the doctor's having a strange collection of mismatched and odd jewelry, which also made them wonder, and an old typewriter was found. Forensic examination of the typewriter showed this was the machine on which the known forged will, that document had been written on. All this directed the investigators to a more detailed investigation, expanding to other patients. Deaths that received the most attention were the ones victims had not been cremated and who had died following a home visit by Shipman, which was generally, those were given priority in the investigation. He would pay an unexpected afternoon house call on a reasonably healthy patient, kill her with an injection of strong painkiller, then hurry away. Later, often summoned back by a frantic call from a relative who had discovered the corpse, he would quickly return and sign the death certificates, saying the unexpected death was due to natural causes. And then, he would notify the mortician. Shipman had encouraged many families to cremate their relatives, stressing that no further investigation of their death was necessary, even when they had died of causes previously unknown to the families. Shipman would provide computerized medical notes that corroborated his cause of death pronouncements when there were questions raised. And it turns out that Shipman was actually altering the records to back up his account of the patient's medical history and why the death had occurred. Shipman should have realized that each time he changed one of the computerized records of his patients, each alteration of the records would be timestamped by the computer, thus setting up a paper trail and timeline for what he was doing. Following many exhumations and autopsies, the police ended up charging Dr. Shipman with 15 individual counts of murder on September 7, 1998, and one count of forgery for forging the will. Now, these were the cases in which they had excellent damaging evidence. He wasn't charged in every case he was suspected of. They only took the cases that they knew they could get a conviction on because the evidence was very, very strong. When Shipman went to trial, his defense attorneys attempted to have him tried in three separate phases. Phase 1, cases with physical evidence. Phase 2, cases without physical evidence. And in the Gundry case with forgery, he wanted that to be filed separately as well. And he requested that all evidence relating to Shipman's fraudulent accumulation of morphine and other drugs be thrown out from his first trial. Well, at first, the townspeople of Hyde, England refused to accept that their neighbor had a trusted physician could be a mass murderer. Businesses hung posters up to support him. They put these in their store window, these big posters that said, "We don't believe it," referencing Dr. Chipman's trial and allegations of murder. These signs gradually came down as the trial proceeded. The community was forced to face facts. The trial proceeded on the 16 criminal charges included in the indictment. The prosecution asserted that Shipman had killed the 15 patients because he enjoyed exercising his control over life and death. Claims of compassion or killing people that were going to die anyway so they'd be out of pain, saying he acted with compassion to ease the patient's suffering. That didn't go far because actually none of his patients were diagnosed with terminal illness. What was on the medical records that may have indicated that was proved to be added to the files later by Shipman. Angela Woodruff, Kathleen Grundy's daughter, appeared as the first witness. Her determination to get to the truth impressed the jury, and attempts by Shipman's defense to undermine her just didn't happen. Government pathologists, or coroners, explained the horrid details of his office's postmortem findings, where morphine toxicity was a cause of death in most of the instances. After that, fingerprint analysis of the forged document and forged will showed that Kathleen Grundy had never even handled the paperwork. Her signature was dismissed by a handwriting expert as basically just a crude forgery. A police computer analyst then testified how Shipman had altered his computer records to create a system or to create symptoms that his dead patients never had, and in most cases, doing so within hours of their death. As the trial progressed onto other victims and the accounts of their relatives, the pattern of Shipman's behavior came much more apparent. He had a lack of compassion, disregard for the wishes of attending relatives, and reluctance to attempt to revive patients who were in a bad place. Soon, other lies documented in the medical records came out. The doctor would pretend to call the emergency services for help while the family was still there with the body, claim he would call and cancel the call when the patient was discovered to in fact be dead. Telephone records showed that no actual call was made. Finally, evidence of his drug hoarding was introduced. with false prescribing to patients who didn't require morphine, overprescribing to others who did, and proof of his visits to the home of the recently deceased to collect unused drug supplies for, quote, disposal. Waste not, what not, I guess. When caught in apparent lies, shipments, inbred arrogance, and constantly changing stories did nothing to endear him to the jury. The court even went so far as to point out to the jury that, in fact, no one had witnessed Shipman kill any of his patients, but to consider the rest of the evidence in the coming verdict they were to develop. The jury was sufficiently convinced by testimony and evidence presented, and they unanimously found Shipman guilty on all charges. 15 counts of murder and one of forgery. The judge passed a life sentence and a four-year sentence for the forgery, while he commended to a whole life sentence, effectively removing any possibility of parole for the doctor. A clinical audit by Professor Richard Baker of the University of Lancaster examined the number and pattern of deaths in Harold Shipman's practice and compared them with other practitioners. It was found that death rates among his elderly patients were significantly higher, clustered at certain times of day, and that Shipman was in attendance in a disproportionately high number of these cases. The audit estimates that he may have been responsible for the deaths of at least 236 over 24 years. Separately, an inquiry commission chaired by the High Court Judge Dame Janet Smith examined the records of 500 patients who either died while in his care. The 2,000-page document and report concluded that it was likely that he had murdered at least 218 of his patients. The commission further speculated that Shipman might have been addicted to killing. In fact, he may have taken his first victim's life within months of obtaining his license to practice medicine. 67-year-old Margaret Thompson, who died in March of 1971, while recovering from a stroke, but deaths before 75 were never really officially opened. Whatever the exact number, the sheer scale of his murderous activities meant that Shipman was catapulted from a British patient killer, the world's most well-known serial killer. According to a few serial killer experts, investigation and documentation of the doctor's history and background comes up short. He was known to have been unusually attached to his mother and deeply traumatized by witnessing her death. Some psychiatrists point out that the sight of the family doctor giving morphine injections to ease mom's pain finally left a mark on his psyche, one that drove him in later life to recreate the traumatic scene again and again and again. Likely we will never really know how this much beloved family physician became England and possibly the world's most prolific serial killer. Aside from being a loner who struck certain teachers as a bit strange, nothing was apparently abnormal about his adolescent time. When Shipman was convicted of 15 murders, his support in the community completely disappeared. Nothing, however, could have prepared the community for the ultimate shock. The revelation, after a prolonged investigation by the British government, that the number of suspicious deaths connected to Shipman may actually be closer to 345. Now, what drove him to it? At his trial, the preceding attorney, Richard Enequez, gave a possible answer. He was exercising the ultimate power of control of life and death, and repeated the act so often he must not have found the drama taking a life of its own. In short, Harold Shipman killed several hundred human beings before he even realized he liked it. On January 13, 2004, Shipman was discovered at 6 a.m. hanging in his prison cell in Wakeford, having used bed sheets tied to a window bar in his cell. There is still some mystery. For example, what happened to the doctor's body after death? Stories will be claiming that his body is still in Shuford Morgan in England. Others will say the family has custody of his body, thinking he may have been murdered in a cell and wishing to delay his interment. It is known that the doctor was cremated. Most likely his family has his ashes. Not exactly what you want sitting on the shelf, but I guess it can raise some talking points in a conversation. Now that's our Shade of Blue story for this week. Thank you, Victoria, for bringing a story to our attention. For more information, you can check out our website, felonfile.com or scottlunsfordauthor.com. You can find links to past podcasts and some shirts and coffee mugs there as well. And I'm told it's a miracle. I've been told that your morning coffee tastes better in a Felon File coffee mug. Give it a try. What does it hurt? In the coming weeks, remember, try to be safe and be secure. And if the opportunity arises, help someone out so that something nice happens. It will make the world a better place in the long run. Thanks again for listening. Victoria, you got the control board back again. And close us out. We'll talk to y'all later. Bye, y'all.
This has been The Felon File, a discussion on law enforcement, history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains and other parts of the world. For more information, you can go to felonfile.com or scottlunsfordauthor.com. Here you can find links to Scott and Num books and other information. You can also email us at felonfile@gmail.com. There are also t-shirts and mugs available. You can also buy us a cup of coffee, or help purchase some of the research material and expenses it takes to do Felon File. Click on the coffee image on the webpage to do so. This is Victoria, your producer. Thank you for listening. Have a good one.